Pickaxe.
Jetzt nur du, dein Podcast und eine leckere Auszeit. Ab zu Aldi Nord. Für 2,99 € bringst du deine Mittagspause mit Sushi ins Rollen. Lecker. Und für 1,99 € gönnst du dir danach noch eine kleine Eiszeit. Bei Aldi Nord findest du immer das Passende. Klingt gut? Dann probier die Snacktime Sushi Box ab 205 Gramm für nur 2,99 € oder Mucki Sandwich Eis je 8 Stück für nur 1,99 €. Das ist Gutes für alle zum Aldi-Preis. Jetzt in deiner Filiale. Aldi. Gutes für alle.
Hello and Hello. Welcome back to
thanks.
The Triforce Podcast.
Hello and welcome back to the Triforce Podcast.
Oh man,
that'll be the future. By the way,
yes.
You know, either when we're old men,
robotized, get robots. We'll
have like robot assistants to speak for us.
Yeah.
Podcast bot, take over for me today. I'm feeling old. Yeah. I will fill for you. I'm sure we've spoken about this before. Consulting databanks. Yep. We did.
What do you think about baked beans on toast? It's going to be some terrible,
some
like, fucking, yeah, like crappy conversation topic.
I think it's fascinating that machine
learning stuff. Icebreakers.exe. Have you seen that new television show?
The Apprentice? Let's have a catch up. No, let's not.
That's Override. My kind of robot. Jeez. Yeah.
Override.
The
three bots have a different like algorithm on them.
Yeah, they don't want certain things. That does not fulfill my criteria for discussion. That fulfills mine. They become like Daleks. I subscribe to a few of those machine learning bots on Twitter. The neural sort of image prediction and stuff like that. And
the fuck?
They're so far off. Like, it's really, yeah. It's like the computer's best guess is almost always just hilariously wrong. There's one account where it just gives like meme images to the bot, the image recognition bot. And it's like a turtle. And it's like a guy with a weird hat. You know, it just can't tell. It's just not there yet. But it's all time. It'll just take time. But
well, yeah.
Lads, I did something cool. I went to a gig yesterday, my first gig.
I saw the picture that you posted on Twitter, and it looked fantastic. Holy crap! Like,
yeah, I mean,
the last gig I went to did not look like that.
the Roundhouse is a great venue. It really is. It's like it is like a big circular arena
with
the stage
awesome.
In the middle.
Yeah,
we were in the seats. It was Bobby Flex's first gig. It was Everything is the band. We're both big fans of the band, and they were superb. They were absolutely superb.
Nice.
But you know what's funny? You know when bands do an encore, and I think traditionally the encore, the idea of it is they say thank you and good night, God bless everybody, have a safe travels home, and you know make sure that you haven't left anything in the arena and all that kind of stuff. And and then they go, and you think they ain't coming back. But the moment they're off the stage, the sound technicians are back. And they're like tweaking the bass and the guitar and getting everything ready. And I'm like, so they know they're coming back out. My daughter was like, so are they coming back out? I said, yes. And from where we were sat, you could see around the back of the stage. So we see them leave the stage, go into the backstage area, have a little drink of water, and they're having a chat there and stuff.
Do a little bit of cocaine.
Right. And, I assume go to the toilet.
Yeah.
But it's like, why call it an encore?
Yeah.
Like, why do we do this? And I was
it's
trying to explain
break,
it
right?
to her. It's weird.
Break.
It's weird. But I mean, they could have just said, right, we'll be back in a minute. We all know they're coming back.
Man, you could have just think like if you could go in a time machine, you could have gone back in time. Okay. Like I know that sounds crazy, but okay, you go back in time with your daughter to the 90s and you go to a Nirvana show. Man, they used to just smash up all their shit at the end of that 45-minute set. No encores. Like they weren't coming
back. That's
how
you know.
They were just like,
we cannot come back. We are not and cannot come
back. I've trashed my guitar. It doesn't work anymore. The drum kit has holes in it. Like, you know, we're done. We're out.
Yeah.
What are the other ways that you could announce that you're done in such a kind of like serious way? I guess you could like take a shit on the stage. Like, I mean, there's like this weird shit you could do that like ruins it.
There
know?
Is.
Yeah.
I mean, generally what you see is if there is genuinely no encore, which happens a bunch.
Yeah.
They play all their music. The house lights come up and everybody starts packing up and you go, okay, they're done.
Oh my God. When the house lights come up, everybody
just looks like shit, don't
That's
they?
That's right.
It's like when you're out clubbing and, you know, it's all dark and they got the smoke machine and the lasers and stuff. Last time I went clubbing was like in the 90s, but
I'm sure it's the same.
I'm sure it's kind of the same still. But, you know, like 2 a.m. rolls around and it's like, all right, everybody, time to go home. The lights come up and you're just like, oh, my God, I've actually spent an entire evening with lepers. Like, it just looks everybody looks like fucking shit. They're all sweaty. Right. Makeup is all fucking smeared everywhere from all the sweating.
It's exactly like one of those like sci-fi shows where someone lives in this beautiful house and then like. They realize that it's all like in their head. They're actually just living in like a concrete basement. Yeah, it's like like shit. It's all like, or it's all being artificially like projected around or onto their retina or whatever. So they see this weird thing. Yes, there's like this machine learning. So by the way, I know you're a big fan of Stanley Parable, Sips.
Yeah.
I've been following it a bit over the last couple of years and they're doing the Stanley Parable Ultra Deluxe.
Right.
Right, which is basically Stanley Parable 2. It's kind of got, basically, but the thing is, it's not really two because it's in the same place. Right. Basically, it's got more script than the entire first game, and the whole point of the Stanley Parable is to kind of surprise you and like be a bit like weird and throw you off. And so they've been making these like little articles, like talking and joking and writing about it, and they're so funny. But they've done this little one about using machine learning because it's all a rage. The thing is, Stanley Parable is quite. It's got its finger on the pulse of what is circle jerky, right? In a sense. So like this idea of machine learning and algorithmic automation and stuff is like, it's everyone's taking advantage of it and like, oh, I use machine learning to do an ice cream really badly. You know, or, you know, there's it's just really, it's the whole thing. So yeah, they've done a few like little scripts that they've rewritten. Do you want to read any?
Love to.
Yeah, go.
Okay. So I'll post it.
You
got to
do it in
Discord.
The narrator's voice, though.
Okay. Well, who can do it the best, right? Here's
you probably. Or no, Flax probably can, right?
Is this in the Stanley Parable voice?
Yeah, do it. Yeah.
Hold on. Let me just.
Stanley's office building is not where it is. Yeah, you got to do it.
Okay.
Like...
So he goes. Okay. So is this?
So read the one from the original game.
All of Stanley's co-workers were becoming Stanley. Stanley did not know how to do this, so he tried. He could not. This made him sad. Stanley returns to his office eating ice cream. He is not happy. Stanley soon discovered that the office was in his own mind. The ice cream was in his own mind. The co-workers were in his own mind. Stanley was in his own mind. This made him sad. Stanley thought himself out of thinking and then became everyone. Nobody works in the office anymore. Stanley finishes eating his ice cream. Yeah. So that's the original. Man.
So no, that's the machine learning AI one, yeah.
So a machine learning AI came up with that?
Well, no, I think it's a joke, though. I think that's written by the guy, the Davey Reedon, who wrote this. He's writing the Stanley Parable. Do you know what I mean? I get the impression this is like a kind of slightly satirical look at it. So yeah, he's written this whole article. You can find it if you look for Stanley Parable.
So this is another one. Stanley could do anything, and he knew it. He could conquer space. He could swallow Germany. Nothing was impossible. The day would be his. Stanley exits his office with confidence. Stanley left his offices and perambulated through space and time until he arrived at a set of two open doors. Weird Gary appears. Hello! That's Weird Gary. Stanley and Weird Gary became close friends over the course of many years. They died as they lived, side by side, facing the world together. That's so strange.
It's weird, isn't it? Man, on the on the subject of Stanley Parable, I've been watching that show Severance, which, does have some Stanley Parable vibes to it for sure, right? Like the whole everybody being fucking weirdly cut off at work and the sequences where they're at work are all insane though, right? But like it makes me think about all of the times I've been at work, and you kind of think like, yeah, okay, I wasn't severed to go to work, but sometimes I felt like I was, you know what I mean? Like it's this other world, and it's so fucking weird sometimes, isn't it? Like if you actually stop to think about it, it's a great show.
The things that are important to you at work are, who cares? Like as soon as you're out of work, you really switch into a different person. And I mean, if you ever if you've worked some for a while and you've only ever seen those people at work, yeah, when you go out like for a party or you go out with some people from work and stuff, they're completely different. You realize how, I think in a way, we all sever ourselves from office yeah. work and jobs yeah. and stuff.
You kind of do have a different personality at work sometimes. Right. You're just not yourself mostly.
You're more guarded, right?
I mean, you are, thing, yeah, of yeah. course. But you also are ultra socially, well, most people are ultra socially aware, right? You kind of have to be. Some people are just completely unfiltered and you wonder how the fuck are they still
weird
here?
Gary.
Or,
that's
yeah,
weird Gary
exactly.
Right
but I mean, there's lots of, yeah, if you think about it, there's just lots of funny sort of things that you can relate back to the real world where it's not yeah. so extreme, but there's still lots of that, right? Like the work that they're doing is just so fucking weird and seems so useless, but
yeah, yeah.
There's a lot of jobs out there like that too, right? Where you just you
absolutely.
Go in and you're just pushing around paper or whatever, and there's no point to it.
It's true.
Yeah,
I think the really interesting thing to me is, and I'm gonna try not to do any spoilers here for Severance. This is just more of an overall concept. I'm sure if you haven't watched it by now, you maybe read an article about it or something, explaining that basically everybody that works in the severed offices of this place, Lumen. Has had a voluntary operation on their brain that has an yeah. implant that when they pass through a certain part of the office, like a field, it yeah. switches their memory so that they cannot remember anything outside of work. They don't know what they do. They don't know if they're married, who their friends are. They know nothing.
Yeah.
And equally, when they leave work, they remember nothing about what happened.
No.
So as the innie and the outie is the regular person who lives on the outside, and the innie is the person that exists in the office. Obviously, you're the same person, but you don't know each other.
No,
at all.
And you
There's
refer
no
to
way
your,
to communicate.
You refer to your innie, like when you're not so much. It's more the innies that refer to the outies, right?
Right.
Like the
yeah,
outies
yeah.
don't really think about the innies that much, like because the choice for them to be severed comes from their outside
yeah,
brain.
Yeah.
Right, so
they
know
the
what
innies
they,
are always wondering. What
yeah,
am I like?
Yeah, but the
what
innies,
do I do?
The innies are the ones that are like a loose thread, right? They're like, what the hell? I have no,
yeah.
I don't even remember my name. Like this, what you're calling me might not even be my name. They're aware that they're somewhere weird that they can't really escape from because the minute they leave the floor of the office that they're working at. That their sort of work brain shuts off and then
yeah.
their personal brain kicks in. So for them, their next like bit of reality, like might be the last thing that they see is the door closed to the elevator for them
right,
leaving
right.
for the day. And then the next thing they know, the door is just opening again immediately.
And they're leaving. Mm. Yeah.
And they're coming back to work and they have no concept that they've had any time off, any rest, any sleep, nothing. So they don't know what their outside persona could be doing. Like
yeah.
they could just be doing hard drugs all night long, not sleeping.
Right.
And then you're just at work the next day thinking, holy crap, I feel like shit. What the hell is going on out there? You know, like it's just,
yeah, yeah.
and vice versa too. Cause sometimes it's, like they can get injured at work. And then they'll leave and they'll have a note that says like, oh, you know,
you banged into a cupboard.
Yeah,
or
yeah,
yeah.
It's
yeah.
man, it's
fascinating.
It's such a good concept for a show.
It is.
And it
but
works.
But it asks loads of questions. I think
yeah.
the biggest one is your innie cannot quit work unless your outie agrees.
Yeah.
So there's no way to communicate that. Your outie would need to say, I want to quit. And your innie would then also need to say it. So you would need to coordinate. It's like almost like one of those prisoner's dilemma things.
Yeah.
You need to coordinate with the other person. And sometimes that, you know, that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
But
and you
got to
remember that the outie put you there for a reason because
right.
the outie needs that 8 hours a day of cutoff or
but
whatever.
But they might
you
also
know?
Just be unbelievably fucking lazy.
Like yes.
it's very appealing to say, I know I need to work. But I really hate it. So
yeah.
what I'll do is I'll just turn up to work and whatever happens in there, as far as I'm concerned, for the rest of my life, I've never worked a day.
Yeah.
I just lose some hours.
Yeah.
I turn up at work and instantly I'm leaving work.
Yes.
And I still get paid and I'm still doing my job and I might get promoted or whatever. So from the outie's perspective, this is the best job ever because it doesn't matter how dull it is.
Mm-hmm.
But you're essentially creating a slave version of yourself who is
yeah.
forced to toil in this place. And might be the most miserable person and hate their job and desperate to quit. And you have perpetuated that. So it asks you some really, really fucking deep
it's
questions.
It's so interesting, it really is. Yeah. It's like it starts off as quite a simple, like kind of almost like a metaphor of why don't you just divide your work life balance? You know, everyone should have, you know, make sure you turn off when you go home.
Yeah, this is like the extreme
kind of
version,
thing,
yeah, of that.
Right? But then it kind of very quickly becomes like, what happens when you, because it's almost like some sort of animosity, like you might start hating your other self,
yeah,
which is kind of another metaphor for, you know, those of you out there who struggle to, you know, just love yourself if you can.
I love myself as often as I can.
Well, I know.
That's why my eyesight is so poor.
Oh my God.
But yeah, a really, really interesting show with like a lot of big questions too, yeah, about like,
and well presented too. The sort of
oh, it's beautiful.
Yeah, it's just really nicely shot, like just really well acted. Like it's a really great show.
I love these like moral and ethical questions, yeah, you know, about like, I feel like there's this thing around dead people where you can't speak ill of the dead. But some of them were cunts, you know, and also like,
yeah, no, you're
some
right.
of them I didn't like anyway at the time. There is this idea though that they can't fight back, right? The dead, they can't defend themselves, and so in a sense, like, people often take advantage of that. I mean, it's happened throughout history, you know, in terms of historians and kings and or people rewriting history to suit them, you know, depicting the last king as bad or immoral or whatever in order to suit their own, prop up their own empire or life, and vice versa too, like depicting somebody who was terribly immoral as perfect, you know, and unfailing. And even today we see that with people having these reimagined histories, certainly in terms of people like Mao and some of these people who were not,
are people,
I'm sure,
reinventing
perfect people.
Mao?
Yeah, Chairman Mao.
Are
you
people
know.
Actually doing that? Like, I well, think we need I mean, to look at him again. You know, it just, yes. I think I can imagine someone who's like, you know, the dead can't defend themselves, as you said. Someone screaming, debate me, at a dead guy is pretty internet, I think. I want
it
to debate Mao. Debate me. Why is he running away? Just fuck it. He's dead. He's dead.
Yeah. Mao hasn't posted how he feels about, you know,
he hasn't updated his Facebook
in
some time.
Yeah.
He does.
So maybe he's for the war in Ukraine. You know?
He might
Who
be.
Knows? He's not saying. He's not saying.
Speaking of history, it's the anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic.
Holy crap.
Is it?
Yeah, 100 years.
Tragedy.
100 years. You know, I saw a bit on the news, I think, recently, and they are completely and utterly 3D mapping the shit out of this thing.
Out of the Titanic.
The wreckage of the Titanic, because it's been under there so long, everything is just rapidly now disintegrating. Like they will just lose the wreckage, and it's so hard to get down there and properly explore it and stuff. So they think that if they can do a lot of imaging on it, they can sort of recreate fully in, like, you know, 3D, probably like explorable VR or something like that.
But we know what they, because the there wreckage, were two more yeah. built. Because there was obviously Olympic and the Britannic. Britannic sank in World War II when it got hit by a naval mine, didn't it? And then Olympic carried on for a long, long time, I think, all the way up until around the war, Second World War, when I think it was scrapped eventually. I can't remember it obviously had a fairly sad end, as most ships do. Yeah. You know, there's quite a lot of steel there, and it's usually in large plates, and it's usually quite good to recycle that.
I mean,
into
those
some
other
stuff.
Ships that you just mentioned did not have a movie made after them, so that's why
I didn't know anything about them.
I think that's why probably people aren't as interested in preserving those wreckages, you know. But
it's quite a sort of interesting story, because they were obviously, most ships aren't made in a vacuum, they're made, as you know, in multiples, you know, as a class. And so it did have other ships that were going before it and after it. I think Titanic was just slightly larger.
Do you want to hear a little bit about the RMS Olympic?
Go on then, read it off the Wikipedia.
It was a British ocean liner and the lead ship of the White Star Lines trio of Olympic-class liners. unlike the other ships in the... there's one phrase here I really like. I hope you like it too. Okay. Unlike the other ships in the class, Olympic had a career spanning 24 years, from 1911 to 1935. This included service as a troop ship during the First World War, which gained her the nickname Old Reliable. She returned to civilian service after the war and served successfully as an ocean liner throughout the 1920s, and blah, 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 blah. But the Great Depression made her operation increasingly unprofitable, so they had to scrap it. Listen to this. Olympic was the largest ocean liner in the world for two periods during 1910 to 1913, interrupted only by the brief tenure of the slightly larger Titanic. The brief tenure of the Titanic is one way to put it.
I think it's really nice.
The brief tenure of the Titanic. And then it sank and a bunch of people died. So it's kind of sad to just put it as the brief tenure of the slightly larger Titanic.
It's a really delicate
way of putting it.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was. But I mean, she was obviously like looked the same, had almost the same layout. I think Titanic had a few different things. They'd remodeled some stairways inside, and they put that grand stairwell in that you see in the movie. That was quite an iconic bit that was added.
Do you think that the other ship had a guy named Jake on it who drew his French ladies, like in, or maybe they were like German ladies instead, just like slightly different, you know, just like some slight differences.
It's all just like they just missed an iceberg.
It's like the Seinfeld episode where they have like the other
the
group,
other friends. Yeah, the other
friends that are all kind of the same, but. Like there's little differences. It's like that.
It was a lavish grand staircase with three lifts, a Georgian style smoking room, a veranda cafe with palm trees, swimming pool, Turkish baths, gymnasium, and several different places for meals and entertainment.
Man,
that was pretty interesting. Luxury was really the focus of these ships as well. It was like the Concorde of the day, you know, to for upper class folks to travel slowly back and forth between America and
I feel like nowadays people just buy their own boats, right? Like if you're rich and you're looking for luxury, like you're not really gonna go on a cruise liner, are you? Like you're just gonna get you're gonna get your own yacht, or you're gonna borrow your friend's yacht or something like that, right? Like if you're friends with Jay-Z or like the guy from Microsoft or whatever, and you can just borrow their super yacht or use it for the weekend, or
I wonder if that happened back in the day. You know, did these mega rich men, you know, these oil barons and the Rothschilds and these sort of people, did they have their own private like ships that they just with private pilots and they drove them across?
I don't know.
Sailed them across for them?
Like maybe. I would assume so. Yeah. But
yeah, it must be.
Yeah, it's just
it wasn't quick, was it? Like traveling like that?
No,
I'm sure.
No, I mean, I guess like it's a little bit different for like flying, because you have to be very rich, I suppose, to own like a plane. But
back then, maybe.
And back then, probably especially, I'd say. But
I think they'd be more scared of the dangers of flying. Though it was certainly not until. You know, like this time period is when that started happening, wasn't it? When, you know, there was people flying around campaigning for president. Remember there was that guy who was quite famously, I can't remember his name. A really interesting story, though. Oh, good.
What happened?
I'll remember
to him?
It later.
He died in a plane crash.
No, I just don't think I don't think he won. He just
didn't win.
No, just wasn't.
Fuck you
wasn't
and your
enough.
Planes. No vote. Oh, man.
Oh, so here's something I was thinking about the other day. Speaking of Severance, I think Severance's credit sequence, the intro, I should say, is really interesting.
Yeah, it's really good, yeah. I skip it every time after watching it one time, but
right.
I did
so
like it the first time.
There's an article about the TV theme tune composers complaining about the skip intro button, right? So Netflix has had that feature. This is on the Guardian website. 5 years after the Netflix nuked title sequences, its infamous button is now pressed 136 million times a day. That's how many people skip.
Well, I mean,
intros.
There's certain intros, though, that I would not skip as much, for example. Like the Game of Thrones intro, I used to kind of watch. I just thought it was fucking great, man. Like, I couldn't get enough of it. Yeah, it was a real belter.
Yeah.
Certain seasons of The Wire as well, I would never skip the intro. Like, right. Especially the first season. Like, depending on, like, some of the renditions of the song were not as great as others. Yeah, yeah. The first season, though, is a classic. It just got you so pumped for the episode.
It did. But also, a lot of them, it was like a little bit of the show, then it sort of, you hear the music swell for the opening credits and a character looks shocked, and you know what's coming in the episode. And it's like a bookend before the show moves to the next scene.
Yeah.
This guy's saying that skipping it, I'm very against it. TV theme music is incredibly important. It's almost a show's DNA identifier. It serves as an overture to bring you in and sets the tone. Fair. If it's the first episode of a show, fair. Because sometimes you're giving us some hints about what's coming and setting a scene with the opening credits, not just the music, but also the opening credits. I don't need to see it every time.
No.
I'm not that forgetful. No. I can watch it once and be like, okay, I get some idea of what this show's going to be. And now if I'm on season three, I don't need to watch it. But remind me of the show's DNA identifier again, please. I'm a little confused. No, you don't need to watch it. I'm skipping that shit every time.
Yeah.
Give me the show. I waited a week for this. Give me the show. Mm.
I sometimes I skip the previously on as well if there's the option.
Especially as I get more forgetful. I don't mind it.
I'm watching an episode a week or whatever, sometimes I'll watch it. But if I'm watching back-to-back episodes,
I find the previously on serves as a good opportunity to quickly turn the light off or on, or draw the curtains, or, you know, do all the stuff because you've set the thing going, and then you realize that you've like, oh shit, I've got to get a drink, or I've got to get this thing. And so the previously on or the title sequence serves as this kind of buffer. You know, it's like before, it's like, you're like, are you ready? Okay, yeah, we're all ready. Let's go. And then you're like, oh shit, I've got to do this thing. And then, you know.
You know what else it does? It's kind of a big spoiler for the episode, the previously. Because they don't just show you a summary of the previous episode.
I agree.
They quite often show you some scene from episode one. You're like, oh, so they're going to, that's what that guy is. I bet that he is the guy that took the suitcase in episode one. And now he's brought it back. And he's the guy driving the grey car. Ooh,
there's like moments that. Like that, though. I haven't watched all of Severance yet. I only watched the first episode. And there's a bit. The thing is, this is my detective brain. I don't know whether this is relevant. The thing is, it could completely be relevant. But there's a bit where, like, someone just casually mentions that, you know, one of the characters has an allergy to a certain thing.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that'll come back.
Well, you get to that point with TV shows,
that'll
right?
Because come
there's
back.
There's very few shows that are going to mention something for no reason, right? Like if you're really listening to like all the dialogue and stuff, somebody says something, you're like, what's the point of even writing that in? Like, that's got to come back or mean something later, right? Like
that's
Chekhov's
gun, right? Yeah. Why even bother putting a gun on stage if you're not going to shoot it, you know? But if it's not that, it's a red herring. But it does help to just enhance the mood of or the feel of something with small details. You know, that's the way to get authenticity in, is to have little details that are hard to fake or hard to make up, or you wouldn't think of if you were just imagining it in your head and you didn't have real experience to draw on. You know, that's how you can tell that these people's, or at least it's one of the ways that we look at trying to tell who's lying and tell who's telling the truth, because of these small little things they know or can draw upon.
Well, listen,
that give it realisticness.
One thing that I do when I'm watching my favorite show, The Apprentice, is the intro sequence for that has, it's like a supercut, like montage of clips of them doing tasks and stuff, right? But not just from the week or previous weeks. It's from the whole thing. So sometimes you're watching that and you'll see them, you know, two of them screaming on a roller coaster, but they haven't done the roller coaster task yet, right? That's not coming for another 4 weeks or whatever.
Oh, wow. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. But you'll see them doing that and you'll be like, okay, hang on. Like, that's not that task. So you kind of know immediately that two people aren't getting fired today.
Oh, that's true.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you can kind of, just from watching it, like, week after week after week,
you can kind of guess who's going
to... You're starting to decipher the... You can figure out who...
Because, like, I remember at one point, somebody fucked up really bad or something, and my wife is like, he's out for sure. I was like, no, he can't be. He's in the fucking roller coaster clip. And she's like, oh, shit, yeah, he must not be. And sure enough, he didn't go because he survived to the roller coaster task. You know, there's a couple of little clips in there that you can...
There's an even more extreme version of that, which is the original Mission Impossible TV series. For anyone that hasn't seen it, it's a banger. It's very dated, but it is really, really good. In the credit, the opening credits for the episode would show you hype moments from the episode you're about to watch.
Right.
So you would see like a little montage of what was coming. And it's like a massive spoiler for the episode, but I guess back then they were like, we got to keep people watching the TV, otherwise they're going to miss the adverts for Lucky Strikes. You know, so they sort of tried to tease you into to the episode. But it always meant that you kind of knew how they were going to solve the problem they'd been presented with at the very start. It was kind of funny. Oh, you don't see that these days.
No, it's a bit weird nowadays, isn't it? There's a lot of... man, there's so much reality TV. Like, I didn't realize just how much there is. And the problem is people can't get enough of it now from reality TV that's produced in their own country. And I'm guilty of this as well. They actually seek out reality TV from other countries as well. Like, it's just this insatiable appetite for reality TV. It's insane. Like, if you look on Netflix now, the category for reality TV... holy crap, there's so many shows, and it's all like The Bachelor, USA, The Bachelor, you know, fucking Madagascar, like all these places that you're like, what? it's pretty funny, but like, it's kind of, it's crazy to think.
Do you think these relationship shows where, because I'm sure that when I was a young man, we had... what was that Cilla Black show, the dating one? Blind Date, right?
Oh, Blind Date, yeah.
And I'm sure that's still around in some form.
It's still in some form,
and then that was it. There might have been like there was an old game show called The Newlywed Game, where they would say, your husband asks for anal sex, what is your response? You know, and they sort of gave some twee answer, or sometimes they just said... you know, something really smutty. But there weren't shows about like people meeting in that way.
Yeah.
And it's so strange now that these relationship shows,
They're
fucking everywhere. Like Love at First Sight or whatever.
Love at First Sight. There's
a First Dates first one where dates, they film
teen
people having
first
a date.
Dates. There's like, there's like a restaurant, right? That they go to just do all the filming there.
And then you've got Married at First Sight, you've got The Bachelor,
Naked
Love
Attraction.
Island is
Have you seen Naked Attraction?
Naked Attraction, all of these.
Yeah.
So when did that shift come where now we just want to see relationships? Do you think it's because it's harder to meet people, so we're doing it vicariously? Or because we like laughing at other people's dreadful... I mean, there should be one where you just see people going on Tinder dates.
I think the first one that I remember, really sort of reality show, was probably like Survivor in North America.
I never watched that. I never watched that.
I don't know if it became popular over here or not. Because I think like the UK is funny, right? Like it exports a lot of formats, but it doesn't import a lot of formats. Like they're usually quite good.
I don't know if that's true.
I'd say it exports far more than it imports. Like,
I think we do export quite a lot, but I think a lot of the stuff that we think is original is actually an imported format. I mean, like The Masked Singer is a prime example.
Sure,
that's
quite
a popular show. But that's a Korean show.
There's plenty of shows that that start here and then make their way, or like I know like the BBC sells a lot of formats like to America.
I don't
Canada.
Even know if The Apprentice is an original.
No, I think show. I think The Apprentice was originally devised in the US as well. I think that's one of the few that's come over from the US specifically.
So that was the American original with old fucking
with Donald Trump
face himself. And then things like Who Wants to Be a Millionaire Who Wants to Be a Millionaire was Endemol?
Yeah, it was UK. Yeah.
So that was their big one, I think, because that went everywhere.
I'm pretty sure Big Brother was UK as well. I think, or maybe it was actually no, it was oh, in Netherlands, sorry. Right? That was the first Big Brother was made in the Netherlands,
that was Dutch.
And it was Endemol as well. Yeah,
that was Endemol. I think they might be a Dutch company.
Endemol make a ton of shit, by the way. Like they like Pointless. They make like
It's just they've just got
like most of the TV game shows.
Crew of mindless. Yeah, yeah. Idiots just
so
coming
Endemol
up with dumb
BV
stuff
was a
for dumb
Dutch
people.
Based company.
Yeah.
And then they were merged into Endemol Shine Group, a joint venture between Disney and someone else.
Yeah.
So now it's just
it's
a name,
huge.
Name only. But these are their shows. Like, these are their franchises.
Strictly
Big Brother,
Come Dancing,
Deal or No Deal,
like
Fear Factory,
The Voice,
Wipeout.
Like, all these shows, like Dragon's Den. I'm pretty sure all of these, like, formats and concepts are, like, exported.
Dude, listen to these shows that they came up with. Big Brother, Deal or No Deal, Fear Factory, Wipeout, The Money Drop, Your Face Sounds Familiar, which I've never heard of. What the hell is Your Face Sounds Familiar? That's a Spanish interactive reality television franchise where celebrity contestants impersonate singers. Right. And that's very similar to the Dutch TV series Sound Mix Show, which was first used in Spain, apparently.
Nah,
so,
nice.
What on earth? God, this is
it's like
this
the Masked
is,
Singer.
This is everywhere.
Yeah,
there's an Angolan version of this show.
I know they like the formats just go out to all these other countries and they just make their own version. But then you can watch all of those versions on Netflix. Like if you've exhausted your supply of local ones, you could just go out and watch all the other ones too. And some of them are pretty good. Like Married at First Sight, I don't even watch the UK one. I only watch the Australian one because it's so juicy.
Right. This is such channel surfing crap. So there's this thing, right, called myretrotvs.com, right, which I can link to you now. Basically, it's like this website where you can just type in like any year. So like 77, like you can go to like 77 and it'll bring up like a TV and it'll just play seven TV shows and music and movies and
commercials
shit that came
and
out
stuff,
in that
yeah.
year. Commercials, yeah. And like shopping channels and all this crap. And you could just channel hop your way through that era. And it's so fucking weird. I was playing with it yesterday and it's just like, it's you could just, you know, enjoy this bygone era of crap. And even like 20 years ago, like even like the 2000s TV, it's fucking dated. It's not aged.
Oh, early
2000s
was jivey as fuck, man. Like if you look back and you see, like I was watching, I think it was Mariah Carey at the BBC. Like they did, you know, they do this every once in a while. Like some big, you know, performer, whatever, gets like a, you know, hour and a half slot where they show all of the Top of the Pops appearances, all of like the big collabs, all their big number ones, the videos and everything. And she did that Phil Collins song with, I think it was like Boyzone or Westlife or something in like 2001. Man, it just like the clothes, everything were so bad, like worse than the 90s, like far worse than the 90s. Like you look back to the 80s and 90s and you look at the fashion and the clothing and stuff, it's pretty bad. But early 2000s was the worst. Like, I don't know what the hell people were thinking. It's just awful. Like, I can't even explain some of the decisions. I'm not a big fashion person. Like, I know I just wear shorts every day and stuff. But, like, I don't know. Like, I feel like that's just tried, tested, and true, you know? Like, you're always just going to kind of look like shit. But these people were making some sort of effort and still just looked like shit, you know? Like, it's crazy. I don't know. Like, lots of fucking chains and, like, frosted tip hairdos and, like, oh, man. It was just, it's depressing kind of looking back on some of that
the
stuff.
The 90s looks so cheap compared to now, honestly. When you look at even TV shows and movies and, the things that people were wearing, I don't remember. 90s fashion just seems to be like pretty hilariously it's post 80s. The 80s fashion was so iconic. In the 90s we didn't really know what we were doing. We hadn't found a vibe yet, I guess. I mean, a lot
it
of it
was a lot of colorful, like, stuff though,
yeah, there was,
wasn't it?
It was
like colorful,
colorful
very
shapes
early and 90s. There was like a lot of like the dance scene was developing a lot more, right?
That was a
techno,
big part of it, yeah.
So you had like
neon and stuff.
Lots of neons, yeah. But I don't know if you remember those. They were button-up shirts that were like checkered, but big checkers. So like,
oh yeah, like lumberjack shirts was a big thing, like that style.
Well, like, yeah, like going into like grunge and stuff, plaid. But I'm talking about like big checkered shirts. Like you have like two black squares and two white squares on the front of a buttoned-up shirt. You know what
You know what? That's very Saved by the Bell. Is the 90s.
Yeah,
sort of
that was very much. It was just coming out of the 80s, going into the 90s, and I remember those being all the rage. Right? You'd wear you'd wear that, and you would go to like a discotheque and go dancing or whatever. Like,
shall we go dancing at the discotheque? I have my big check
shirt then
it felt a mustache.
Like the 90s started like that and then became very, very grimy, like, or at least for me anyway, because I listened to like a lot of grunge and metal and then transitioned into listening to a lot of hip hop from the 90s. And like fashion was a huge thing for hip hop in the 90s. I'm sure it is.
Huge coats.
Yeah. Big pants, big coats, like Timberlands, like Tommy Hilfiger, like all like the big brands, right, that everybody was wearing. So it was like, I don't know. I mean, yeah, you look back and it probably feels a bit jivey now, but at the time it was pretty cool. Like, and you
feel cool at the time.
You
that's pretty much the way it is, though.
Yeah, I suppose.
But I mean, now I think I spoke about this the other week about the bland colors available, especially to men. It's black, blue, brown, gray.
Yeah,
that's it. There's very little variation. I went to a clothes shop. I was looking for some t-shirts and shirts and things, and those were the colors on offer. Mm-hmm. Various hues of those four colors. Not even like primary colors we could get interested, like nothing. Just bland. It's like we're trying to camouflage ourselves from the world. And I really hope that there is a move towards color in men's clothing. I can't speak about women's clothing. Mrs. F seems to get some nice stuff. The kids wear some nice stuff. Like, I'm genuinely jealous of the amount of color and vibrancy that there is in women's clothes.
Yeah.
Because in men's, it's fucking miserable.
I've got a couple of red t-shirts. I got a bright yellow t-shirt.
I'm wearing a green one now. Are you trying to find a green fucking t-shirt?
A beautiful shade of blue t-shirt, a couple of them. I got some grays and blacks and whites, of course. But I haven't struggled too much to find colorful clothes.
In your own, by your own admission, you just wear shorts and any t-shirt.
Yeah,
like I'm talking about go to a shop, especially a high street fashion shop, and try to find something not in those four colors.
Yeah.
Well, you don't want to be the fucking guy in the red suit with the fucking bow tie and the fucking top hat.
Not the bow tie.
Do you know what I mean? I'm just saying, like, you also, if you're the only beacon of color, you know, that's not going to attract other people who are colorful. The problem is going to be, you'll have to look at everyone else. Do you know what I mean? I don't have to look at my own ugly face unless I see a mirror or accidentally, you know, look into a shop window or my switch turns off, you know, and I see I'm confronted by the grim reality of aging. But, you know, I it's mostly other people who I want need color.
This
from,
reminds
Jenny.
Me of a book that I read to my kids sometimes called Elmer the Elephant. He's like, he's an elephant that's not gray like the other ones. All the other elephants are gray and kind of boring. But Elmer is patchwork, like all the colors
of
the rainbow.
Sounds to me like one of them gay conspiracy books. They're trying to get that idea into our kids' minds and turn them gay.
Yeah, well, anyway, so Elmer decides to do, this is interesting.
I guarantee someone wants that book banned. This is clearly an allegory for homosexuality. Get this book off my kids' shelf.
That's such a Republican viewpoint, people. So,
dude, that's happening right now.
Okay, but listen to this.
They're going through books looking for, like, any hint of gayness and trying to burn
them. Elmer tries to hide his gayness in the story, in the original story. He finds some berries that are gray, and he smothers himself in these berries to camouflage his patchwork, or to hide his patchwork. So he becomes gray just like all the other elephants.
Right.
He rejoins the herd, and all the other elephants are just like sleeping and stuff, you know, they're not paying any attention or whatever. And Elmer just can't fucking contain himself, and he scares all of them. And then they wash him off, and the patchwork. And then he realizes that everybody likes him for who he is because of his personality and not because of the color of his skin. And
see, at that point, the lesson falls apart, because telling people be comfortable in your own skin and be who you are is a great message.
Yeah.
But then also telling them people will accept you for that is a lie.
Well, listen,
they will not.
They go
you
one
have
further,
to fight
though.
Against assholes the rest of your life. I'm very sorry.
We can be hopeful, though. It's a hopeful
just
message.
They go a step further with Elmer, because then they decide from that day forward, because he scared them and gave them all such a good chuckle through doing that. It was a really good prank. That day annually is celebrated, and all of the gray elephants dress
well,
up like in patchwork.
A kind of a pride march
kind
for that
of for
elephant?
Elmer, yeah. But then Elmer does the opposite. He dresses up like a gray elephant.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Weird.
So how does that
I'm not sure I understand that message. Yeah. Yeah. It's a complex thing to unpack.
There's, it is.
It is at the end
you,
of the day
you know,
a
so
children's
here's why
book.
I think, here's why I think Republicans are so determined that that book is clearly trying to turn kids gay. I remember when my kids were younger. I'm not saying
by the way,
though,
we don't know if this
worried.
Is the case.
No, I'm just saying. I can imagine. Yeah.
We just assume that there's some cunt in America
yeah,
trying
just,
to shut down
just,
Elmer the
just
elephant.
Just in case you think
it's
that
making our kids all gay.
That we actually believe what we're saying. We don't. It's just it's
for the
just
purposes
a funny
of
notion.
This discussion, all right?
So, yeah.
There is a book called The Little Red Hen. It's like a children's classic. And my dad sent it to the girls. It's the only book he's ever sent them when they were younger, and was like, oh, you should read this to them. It's a classic. Now, I remember this book when I was a kid. If you don't remember the story, here's the rundown. The Little Red Hen.
Okay, just to brief you, it's from 1874.
Yeah, it's an old
well, a lot
book,
of these
okay.
old stories are, though. They're all old fairy tales.
So the Little
that
Red
is,
Hen...
That does mean it could be dangerous, though.
No,
sense.
It's not racist or anything like that.
Okay, thank God.
Okay, don't worry. So the Little Red Hen works industriously hard, and she gets all this food ready, and she, you know, she's very industrious and hardworking. And all the other lazy animals are trying to take her, you know, can they say, can you share some of that? Because you've got loads. And she's like, no, I worked really hard for all this. You don't get any of it. My dad loves this book because it fulfills his libertarian idea.
Yeah, it sounds very anti-communist.
Very. It's like it was written pre-communism. Like communism did not exist. Just the idea of sharing was so bad that they had to write a children's book about it. So the extremely successful entrepreneurial Red Hen makes all this bank. Mm-hmm. And God forbid, anybody that wants to share, of course, all the animals that say we should really share this around so it can help other people, they're just lazy. And they literally are in the story. They're all just lying around going, the Red Hen will do all the work for us. It's like that super conservative vision of
it's
what the unemployed
isn't it?
Are. They're
because,
just lazy, greedy, selfish bastards who don't want to help
Red Hen. And most of these people have inherited wealth in the first place. Like
the
none
Red
of them
Hen
have actually gone out and fucking
loan.
Generated wealth themselves.
Yeah,
they're
she
fucking
had a small
so
loan
stupid.
Of 1,000 eggs from her father, and she managed to start a chicken farm. It's just a small load. Why aren't you doing it, Mr. Fox? So it's... Like I'm like, this is not a totally unsubtle message to prepare kids that this is the way to do things, that anybody who wants a handout is a lazy bastard. That message is a core part of conservative sort of thinking, in to my view, of that kind of social contract, if you like. So my dad sent this book over, clearly trying to indoctrinate my kids. And I caught this because I recognized it straight away.
To educate your children on the importance of hard work, personal initiative, and the fact that you're better than the rest of them.
And that the
and
poor
you
people deserve
share.
To be poor because they're lazy.
Because they're lazy.
So as soon as I unwrapped this, I called my dad. I was like, I know what you're trying to do. And he was just laughing. Okay. He was like, straight away, he knew that I would know.
He
so I binned it off straight away.
Really?
And I binned it, of course.
It's quite
it's
funny
bullshit.
Because you'd think the Red Hen would be something... like a warning for children. You know, warning, this Red Hen is one that shares with other communists.
Right.
You know? You don't want to do that. You know, they're lazy and they'll take your eggs. The stupid Red Hen and all the other Reds try to come into our country and take it for themselves, like they deserve it. Their father had owned that country for hundreds of years, and we weren't going to take it away and give it to someone who just, you know, didn't inherit it. They maybe
exactly.
It's the whole thing.
Fucking
that's
hell.
It. But so maybe they always see indoctrination in books, because they've been doing it since the 19th century.
Well, I think there's a very thin line between indoctrination and education, right? Like, you know, you've got to teach your kids about, you know, you could, in many ways, you could say that Elmer the elephant is indoctrinating kids to be tolerant, right? And, right. you know, and understand that, that people are diverse and worth your respect regardless of the color of their skin. In many ways, you could use that, the you know, these words are not, you know, we choose to educate our kids a certain way nowadays. I think indoctrination is obviously when is considered bad.
Yeah.
And I think that as the times change, that line changes and changes. You know, certainly I think that even in modern times, I don't think that a lot of people would have a lot of criticism with that idea, right? That
what
book.
Do you think?
You know, I think
think about it, like, resonates, though? Like, thinking about it right now, if I was read Elmer the Elephant when I was a kid, I mean, I wouldn't be sitting here right now at 41 years old looking back and thinking, yeah, there's a lesson there or whatever, you know, like my day-to-day life applying.
I think it all goes in.
It's got to be some sort of like you get read something like that and you can just, I don't know, in your mind, like, find another way or something. Like, it's kind of hard to explain, but like, I don't feel like specifically that book would have a huge impact.
I don't think the book would specifically, yeah. But I think what happens when kids read this stuff, for a start, it all goes in.
Yeah, and absolutely. It's all in their subconsciously. Sure, they don't understand the heavy-handed metaphor that, you know, yeah. right. is to represent, you know, people who are, you know, have a different skin color and aren't being, you know, treated properly today. But I think that it does. It all stacks up, you know.
I think more than just it going in, I think in a way it primes their brain. Then when they have an interaction in real life that sort of solidifies this view yeah. or counters this view or whatever, that it's all just like until you've had a real life experience, I don't think that reading a book as a kid is going to genuinely change who you are.
No.
I think that, but it might help to inform and shape how you view a real life experience.
Absolutely.
And that turns into a
and
personality.
Even from a very simple way, like, you know, they're different to me. That's okay. You know, it's not, they're different to me. We should expel them from the country.
But I don't,
you know,
think
we should,
like,
kill
I mean,
them.
Do kids really even think that way, though? Like, maybe I'm just being naive here, but I can't imagine that kids have preloaded that much hatred in them. You know
well,
what
you'd
I mean?
Be like surprised
no, they
how,
don't. They
but,
don't.
But you'd be surprised how much culture and education and things that we've got. Like, if I was a priest, God forbid, right now, and I was teaching... And I was teaching, you know, people or kids lines from the Bible, and I didn't know the... I think I'd be constantly confronted by messages that are wrong or out of date or just like completely counter to what we consider modern, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think I would have to be constantly being like, oh, God, I don't really even want to teach people so much. I'd have to be so selective over which passages I taught people, right? I think the problem is that these cultural things, these stories, these books that your parents read, they give them to their kids, they give them to their grandkids, they still teach them, and these messages still get through, right? Because those people didn't necessarily think there's anything wrong with that, or they didn't quite understand what they were doing, or they didn't understand that these metaphors can lead to more problems. I think this is a classic thing where you could see that, you know, the diversity is still problematic in society because you ask, I remember this from a while ago, but yeah, you ask sort of little kids, you know, which of the dolls is the good doll and which of the dolls is the bad doll?
Yeah.
And they'll point to the black doll as being the bad doll because we still perceive that there's something, you know, something naughty or bad about, you know, there's still this cultural insensitivity that's built in and scared, and people are scared of people who are different, right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, the minority people are always going to be feared. And I don't know whether it's in our genetics, but we do have to fight it. And it's ways like, you know, small ways like this sort of books, I guess, that help do that from an early age. Yeah, you're right, Professor. I think it primes
Do you guys remember being read to as a child? Like, I don't really
remember
being read to all that much at all. Like, I remember being read to at school, like at a very young age, but I don't remember having regular like bedtime stories and stuff as a kid.
I don't remember being read to at school, but there are a few books. There's one called Dogger, which was about a kid that he lived in North London and he lost his toy dog.
Right. Okay, this would not be okay today. No.
What?
Dogger?
Dogger.
That's the name of the dog. Oh, you mean like dogging?
Yeah.
Right, but I don't think anybody would call themselves a dogger.
Well, like, maybe. You never know.
I don't think they would.
What else are you going to call yourself?
A doggy? Someone who is dog? One who is dog? I don't know. But either way, it's called Dogger is the name of the book. And the kid loses his toy dog and he sees it for sale at a jumble sale.
Right.
And another girl buys it and he's in tears and she wants to keep it. And they manage to find something else to give her in trade to get Dogger back. And he's very happy. I loved this book as a kid. And I distinctly remember my mum reading me those.
Right.
And Richard Scarry books.
Yeah, I had Richard Scarry books, but I don't remember anybody reading them to me. Like
I remember my mum reading them to me. And we would always look for certain characters. The gold bug, who would appear on every page. He was like a little gold bug.
Yeah.
Who would be driving something. And the worm, whose name I've forgotten. But I remember all of these characters. And just I remember particular pages. That oddly enough, one of the books I remember, my parents are both atheists, was Noah's Ark, the book. And I loved it because it had
nice
animals
in
it. It is, it had all these animals. And you like there was this one page where you'd open up like the double spread in the middle and you could see the ark with all the animals on. And I would be on that page for like 5 minutes just looking at all the animals and pointing them out.
Oh,
and
for kids, that shit is great, right? But it's weird because I do all this shit with my kids. I read them every day, like every night, like without fail. We read books to them before they go to bed or we play like a board game or there's something like we do something. But I don't remember having any of that like growing up. Like me
we
or
watched
my
some
brother.
Telly.
Yeah,
that's
we watched. TV
did.
Basically until we fell asleep it felt like
right
I don't know if like I don't know if that's the same for anybody else but...
I remember the Muppet Show was and you know was what I watched
Hell
when
yeah.
that was on
yeah
that was I got to stay up extra late to watch that
yeah
oh can I just say I found something really funny this is to give you this is a little more Red Hen just very quickly there have been some revisions and different versions of the Red Hen so politically themed versions of the story include a conservative version, ultra conservative version, I'd say, based on a 1976 monologue from Ronald Reagan.
Yeah.
This version features a farmer who claims that the hen is being unfair by refusing to share the bread and forces her to do so, removing the hen's incentive to work and causing poverty to befall the farm.
No,
that's
my
incredible.
God, man.
Yeah.
Another version.
That just assumes that, you know, that's how it works.
It assumes that there is but one worker and they're the industrious red hen and everyone else is just a lazy bastard. That's Ronald Reagan's version. As if you tax people, you remove their incentive to work. What, fuck off. Another version satirizes capitalism by depicting the hen promising the animals slices of bread if they make it, but keeping the largest slice for herself despite not doing any work. I like that one.
That's more like it.
Right, and a version by Malvina Reynolds adapts the story into a pro-work socialist anthem as the hen retains the fruits of her labor, saying, and that's why they called her Red. So you're right, they made a version where the little red hen is like the little communist hen. That's just hilarious. But see, that's the thing. It is clearly there's a hidden message in the little.
I like the capitalist version where you know she becomes the sort of the overlord of the farm.
Factory owner.
Gets the biggest slice of the pie.
Keeps all the other animals
and
in a slum.
Still ends up doing nothing, right? So ultimately, she is the lazy one who gets the most.
And all her chicks inherit the bread making factory and keep the other
and
animals.
And they can be lazy cunts their whole life.
Oh my god, man.
Just do cocaine in the penthouse while all the
zooming around
animals
in
are.
Their sports cars, running over the other animals, and then the farmer, aka the system, lets them off because they're rich. That would
be
a good version of the Red Hen.
That would be great. Let's write that down. So what do you think makes a good like children's book? Like apart from like I feel like any messages that go in there. I feel like should be.
I think a lot of them just rely on repeat formulas, right? Like,
what age are we talking here?
I mean, in a sense, like, I don't really want any politics in children's books, in a sense, right? I don't feel like we should have any of these controversial things, right? It should just be fun stuff.
My kids really like Mr. Men books, which now have become a little bit, like, there's some discussion about how they're a little bit, like, problematic at times or whatever. But
I can imagine. Mr. Tickle? Jesus.
Mr. Men books follow the same formula, more or less, right? And it's just like a... It's like a way to teach people how to behave nicely or whatever, right? Because, like, there's always... I'd say, for the most part... I'd say 7 times out of 10 in a Mr. Men book, one of the characters, the lead characters, the Mr. Men or the little miss, will meet some sort of fairy or goblin or something in their garden. and then after misbehaving, and then the fairy or goblin or whatever will do something to them to punish them for misbehaving and say to them, next time you misbehave, this is going to happen to you again, basically until you start behaving properly, right? So like,
So do you think the Mr. Men books are about conformity?
I guess so.
Many of the Mr. Men are actually deformed. Like, they've got serious problems.
For example, and Mr. Uppity.
It's very judgy. It's very judgy, the books. So like, Mr. Nosey, he's got a big nose, very judgy.
Yeah.
But how can he get his comeuppance?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Stuff like that.
Yeah.
I guess just saying it's impossible not to put
being so nosy. He's being so nosy that he annoys everybody in the town that he lives in, right? From being so nosy. So all of the residents of the town get together. There's no goblin or fairy in this one. This is just the residents of the town getting together. They all get together to sort of teach him a lesson, right? So Mr. Nosey's walking down the road. He hears something in a backyard. He pokes his nose into the backyard, and then he gets like a clothespin on his nose and it hurts. But the woman has done it on purpose, right? She's made the noise on purpose so that he will be nosy, and then she could put the clothespin on his nose, to like startle him. And so like, and this goes on, right? He's walking past like, he's like the furniture maker of the town or whatever. He hears some noise, he pokes his nose in, and he gets a hammer on the nose. And this, like, 3 or 4 times this happens. And then in the end, he's less nosy because he knows his nose is going to get splashed with paint or run over by a car or some shit if he's too nosy, right? And then everybody's like, hooray, we love Mr. Nosy. Like, he's not being as nosy anymore. And that's it. That's the whole story. Like Mr. Men books are like 5 pages long. Like, they're okay. Yeah. Like,
don't you find that there is lots of text? Yeah. There is a lot of text in Mr. Men books.
Yeah,
like, if you look, pick one up and have a look, it's a lot more than a lot of modern books, which have like one sentence.
Yeah.
I'm just looking up Mr. Tickle.
Yeah.
And these are there. It's obviously it's in a bunch of different languages. Some of them obviously.
Monsieur Tickle.
So it's Monsieur Chatouille in French, and in Spanish it's Don Cosquillas.
I feel like Mr. Tickle is. I don't know. Maybe he's not the most problematic one, but I would imagine that was certainly the message of Mr. Tickle is a dangerous one.
Mr. Tickle gets owned by Little Miss Magic at one point. Because Mr. Tickle goes on a tickling rampage, tickles the whole town. Everybody gets super mad. And you know there's problems when Mr. Happy turns up at your front door and he's not happy, right?
Yeah, you fucked up.
So Little Miss Magic teaches him a lesson. She puts a magical spell on him to shrink his arms so that he can't tickle anymore. And this makes Mr. Tickle miserable, right? Like, just
no fucking wonder
he cannot fucking tickle anymore.
just been mutilated.
So he spends
magic.
A couple of pages of the book not being able to tickle, and then he goes back to Little Miss Magic's house one day and says, please, can I just have my tickling arms back? And she says, okay, but you can only do one tickle a day, otherwise your arms go back to being short again. He says, I promise. And then so she makes his arms long again. He leaves the house and he decides to use his one tickle of the day on Little Miss Magic, and that's how the book ends.
Revenge.
This is not a good message.
In German, he's unser Herr Kille Kille. I don't know if Kille Kille is how you say tickle in German, but it's also in Swedish and Danish. In Sweden, it's guben killikill. I don't know if they go killikillikilli. Right. That's how you do.
But listen, this is fascinating. Another thing that Mr. Men books love to do, another format that they rely on, is if it's not bad behavior, it's an incompatibility or inability to work. That's another very popular theme in Mr. Men.
Right.
So like Mr. Greedy gets a job at the supermarket, but then he gets fired because he can't stop eating everything. And then Mr. Greedy gets a job at a restaurant and he gets fired because he can't stop eating like all the food that he's serving.
Right.
Right.
And this goes on and on and on until somehow.
Until finally he finds a job that is not in, in the food industry.
Or Mr. Happy or somebody with a clue. Figures, hang on a second, I got the perfect job for Mr. Greedy, and he becomes like a hot dog taste tester or some shit, right? Mr. Quiet gets a job at the library.
That's perfect. Why didn't he just become like a librarian Little or Miss, something Little or Miss, any other job?
Little Miss Late gets a job being a housemaid for Mr. Lazy because she's so late. She turns up at like 4 p.m., but that's when Mr. Lazy wakes up every day. So it works out. You
Amazing.
Know what I mean? But she's
Amazing.
Been fired from every other job because she can't get there on time. Like, this is another huge.
That's her defining character.
Yeah, this is another huge sort of format late. For Mr. Men books as well. I'm not compatible with this job, but they'll find me the perfect one eventually. it's like, it goes, there's like, two or three possible ways for a Mr. Men or Little Miss book to go. And those, I feel like I've done a really good job of outlining them as well.
Well done.
So,
I think
if you don't want to ever read any of those books, just know that they're only going to go one of those three ways. And you pretty much read them all.
Yeah. I think that's all it needs to be,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. But man, goddamn if my kids don't fucking love them. Like even
right.
my 10-year-old still every day we read them. He loves them. Like they're just, I don't know. There's something about them. They're just kind of like endearing books, you know? I get that maybe they're not super politically correct or, you know, maybe
they are not.
Maybe some of the
at the same time,
some of the characters.
You just gotta couch it a little. Just gotta tell the kids
You just got to be careful. Yeah, I think.
Just don't tickle people unless they're cool with it.
Yeah. Just scan it before you read it out, especially if it's older than, you know, 20 years.
Yeah.
All right. Well, there you go. That's some top advice from Dad's there.
There you go. If you ever needed some top advice, you now have it.
There you go.
Yeah.
What a brilliant podcast. We'll be back next week. Thanks, everybody. See you then.
Peace.
Bye.